Good morning, everyone. Judge Hamilton and I are very honored today to have United States District Court Joan Lefkoe as part of our panel. We feel very privileged indeed, and so should you.
Okay. Nice to be here.
All right. Case number one is number 103903, and it's Lady Dyes, Inc. versus Enhanced Services. So, come on up, Mr. Gilchrist. Great. Now, you still want your three-minute rebuttal, right?
Yes, please.
Okay. Usually a good idea.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. This Court should reverse the District Court's order denying class certification and granting the defendant's motions for summary judgment. District Court's error in this case allows the defendants to keep payments for improper charges. A duly promulgated rule of the Indiana Regulatory Commission says they cannot. That rule, Indiana's anti-cramming law, sets this case apart from cramming cases that have arisen around the country under various states' laws that simply are not the same as Indiana's. Indiana's anti-cramming law sets minimum threshold requirements that must be satisfied before the defendants can place vendor charges on a local telephone bill or before they can collect money for those charges. Those minimum requirements are simple, but they're meaningful. The defendants must possess specific supporting documentation of a valid charge before it is placed on the phone bill. If they don't satisfy that threshold requirement of Indiana law, they don't get out of the gate. We don't reach any of the other issues that the district court turned to.
Mr. Gilchrist, bottom line, aren't you essentially using the tort of unjust enrichment as a vehicle for creating a private right of action for code violations? Because under your interpretation, it seems as if any violation of a consumer protection code provision would be actionable under an unjust enrichment theory.
I'm not sure that I would go so far as saying that every violation of a code or consumer protection code even would give rise to an unjust enrichment claim. Indiana does have a solid body of case law that says that where a statute or a regulation specifically prohibits the charging of a fee, then an action in equity for restitution or unjust enrichment is available.
But what's unjust about a defendant who retains the payment for a service that was authorized and received?
Well, in this case, we have a regulation that decides whether it is authorized or not authorized. Our IURC, at the direction of our General Assembly, passed rules that decided when you would be permitted to charge such a fee and when you would not be permitted to charge such a fee, and went so far as saying that you, in fact, cannot charge or recover compensation unless you meet these requirements. Now, that may have been a paternalistic move on the part of our state government, but that is the law as it stands.
So, in other words, equity would no longer matter at all. The legal violation alone suffices to allow recovery under your theory.
I wouldn't say that equity no longer matters. I think how I would state it is that...
Well, what is equitable about this?
Well, what Indiana courts have said is that the equitable result, when a statute specifically prohibits a fee, the equitable result is the return of that fee. That's what the Lawson case stands for.
The result you're talking about, though, allows your client to order the services, receive the services, and then never pay for them. How is that equitable?
It is possible that...
That's the result you're insisting on, right?
That is the result that we think is the right result under the law as it exists.
I gather from your complaint, Mr. Gilchrist, that you all were surprised when the tapes were produced indicating that your client had, in fact, ordered these services.
I don't think that we were surprised that tapes were produced. That we understood that that's how they purported to document authorization in these cases.
Is there a question about their authenticity?
No, there's not. That's okay. Not an issue.
So the client did order the services?
Correct.
Okay.
Well, Judge, I'm trying not to make that that's simply not an issue in the case.
Oh.
Okay.
We will decide if it's an issue in the case. No, you don't want to say that to us.
I'm sorry, Judge. I certainly don't. Let me put it this way. I think that the purpose of these regulations is, I know you'll do that, Judge.
I know.
I think the purpose
of I'm being silly.
But I certainly appreciate your advice. But I think that the purpose of these regulations is to make that not the issue in these situations. The issue of whether somebody agreed or didn't agree on the phone. That has, as you know, has created litigation across the country, has raised issues with federal authorities and so forth.
Right. And the IURC could have created a private cause of action
right.
when it wrote the regulation if it wanted to, correct?
They could have created a private cause of action under the regulation.
But they didn't.
Presumably
do so.
The legislature would have, that was within the scope of their rulemaking authority. Maybe, maybe
That's
not,
correct.
But they didn't do it.
That's correct.
And instead left you to more general common law and equitable standards that introduce these other elements into the mix.
That's correct. The IURC's regulation was adopted under the presence of a common law in Indiana that permits equitable claims for the recovery of charges that are prohibited by the law. If there's a policy reason for what the court may be suggesting would be a windfall to class members, the problem of cramming is one where many class members don't even know that a phone call has purportedly resulted in the ordering of charges. What the IURC has done is to move the documentation and proof requirements and responsibility for placing charges closer to the customer. A phone company or its billing agent has to possess documentation before a charge can be put on a bill. And that way, the class member, the customer, is not looking to somebody four steps down the chain to answer the question of how did I supposedly order this charge. So there's a policy reason for doing that. Now, Indiana cases have addressed the issue of a purported windfall under these equitable circumstances or benefits to persons who are seeking restitution.
Will you concede that there is absolutely no case support for your interpretation?
I'm sorry, which interpretation, Your Honor?
Well, your interpretation of what the code permits.
No case has addressed what is compliance or not compliance with the anti-cramming regulation. That's correct. Cases like United Financial Services, the Nordhaus case, these are cases that we've cited in our brief. They do address the question of restitution and whether that somehow results in a windfall to the person receiving restitution.
Well, there's no question it would be a windfall. There's no question that it would be a windfall.
What the cases do say, though, Your Honor, they say that a full restitution is the appropriate remedy. If the fee is prohibited by the law, parties will not be treated as being in peri delicto. We will not look at the balancing question of what benefit did this person receive. We will order full restitution. That's the appropriate remedy.
Mr. Gilchrist, what you are trying to do is you are trying to essentially transform the unjust enrichment claim into a private right of action for code violations. And that was not the intention of the Indiana State Legislature, or they would have done it, as Brother Hamilton maintains.
Or at least implies.
Oh, all right.
The cases in which our courts have found that you are entitled to restitution of fees that are paid when they are prohibited by law do not look at the law for the cause of action. They don't say you're only entitled to restitution if the law that creates the fee prohibition says you're entitled to a cause of action. When a fee is prohibited by statute, it's prohibited, and you can recover it back. In fact, going back to the Michener case, which is a case from the early 20th century, they say that a fee paid in violation of a statutory prohibition implies a promise of repayment. And there is no question of impera delicto. That's the remedy that the law imposes when the fee is prohibited. You don't look to the statute for that remedy. You look to equity for that remedy.
Mr. Gilchrist, could I ask you about your statutory claim?
Yes.
The relevant statute, Indiana Code 24519.3, refers to goods not yet ordered or services not yet performed and not yet ordered. Is there any doubt that your client ordered the services here? And if not, why doesn't that defeat the statutory theory?
Our client, under application of the regulation, again, that is what decides whether a LEC billed service
We're talking here about ordering within the scope of Section 3.
Correct.
Are you saying ordered means implicitly and in compliance with all applicable law?
Well, I will say this, Your Honor. The statute says that the provisions of the chapter don't relieve persons of the obligation to comply with other law. We read that to mean that it should be read together with other law. That's my first point. The second is that the statute doesn't tell us exactly what does it mean to say something is ordered or not yet
That's
ordered.
That's not a hard question.
Whether
is it?
Well,
whether services were ordered when there's a taped phone call or a digitally recorded phone call with your client ordering the services.
Under other states' law, that might be an easy question. But when you have a law that says this is the only way that you can bill and charge for LEC billed services, then you have a contract that's not enforceable, because to enforce it is to violate the law. And there's, again, longstanding case law.
It's not violating the law for the parties to go forward. The regulation would give your clients a perfectly good defense if they were sued in small claims court to collect on 6 months' worth of charges, for example.
Well, our position, Your Honor, is that a contract that does not – when that purported contract came into the hands of the defendants, when it didn't comply with the law, it could not be called a valid order for services. Under the regulation, you don't have a valid order for LEC billed services if you don't possess the documentation.
Could you also explain to us, in your view, how these defendants are billing agents for either an LEC or a PIC, when, as I understand it, what they're telling us is we're AT&T is a customer of ours?
That's the position that they've taken in their briefs. And as we've pointed out in the record, in at least one of their contracts, they've stated to Verizon, which is one of the LECs at issue, that they are a billing agent.
For whom?
For the LEC. Well, actually, I take that back. I don't think it says for whom, but it says they are a billing agent.
They're obviously a billing agent for the service providers, right?
I don't know that that's obvious. I think in this chain of what they do, they offer the billing service.
Well, let's say Advanced Business Services pays the defendants to collect this information, aggregate the bills, send it to AT&T or to Verizon.
Correct.
For direct billing to the customers.
Yes.
So they're obviously billing agents for Advanced Business Services in that situation, right?
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes.
How are they agents for AT&T or Verizon?
They're also billing agents for the local phone companies, because they essentially act as dual agents. They're intermediaries.
That's a conclusion. How are they agents for AT&T or Verizon?
They have an agreement with AT&T and other local phone companies by which they are charged with gathering charges to be placed on phone bills, deciding if those charges comply with the law and are valid.
I have to say, it looks like AT&T and Verizon are billing agents for the defendants, mm-hmm. right? They're collecting money from their customers and then passing it on to these defendants, who pass it further upstream, right?
Well, if they were billing agents for the LEC, I don't think the regulation would treat the billing agent and the LEC as separate entities. And I believe that if you look at the chain of how this process occurs, how charges are put on it.
I understand, I think, how it works. I'm trying to understand whether the regulation as written accomplishes the purposes that you think it does.
We believe that they are billing agents because they, first of all, billing agent is not defined, but we believe that that is the only understanding of billing agent that makes sense under a regulation that is intended to control charges that go through this particular chain of entities to arrive at the phone bill. And when the regulation says a LEC or a LEC's billing agent must possess this documentation, we believe that that's the natural understanding of that is the entity that sits in the shoes that the defendants are in. I'd like to reserve whatever time I have left for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Cox, good morning.
May it please the Court, my name is Dina Cox. I represent Enhanced Services Billing, Inc., or ESBI. I'm here to argue on behalf of ESBI and ILD Telecommunications. Two essential questions are presented to this Court, we believe, on appeal. What is unjust or unfair about a customer being charged for services that the customer wanted and received? What is deceptive about a customer being billed for services that they wanted and received and in a fashion to which they agreed?
But neither of those were the bases for Judge Barker's decision in this case, however, were they?
Your Honor, I believe the summary judgment decision in favor of the defendants on both the unjust enrichment claim and the statutory deception claim recognized that plaintiff failed to present evidence creating a genuine issue of material fact on both of those torts. So implicit in that finding.
Well, that no, but Judge Barker ruled based on the voluntary payment doctrine, right?
That was one basis, yes.
And if I'm remembering correctly, finding there was no intent to deceive.
Right.
But that's not an element of an unjust enrichment claim.
She found voluntary payment doctrine barred the unjust enrichment claim. She also found that there was no measurable benefit retained.
Because of the refunds
or
so
credits.
So she didn't decide there's no claim simply because the services were actually provided and authorized.
I read her order to imply that authorization was key to a claim for unjust enrichment. And let me just say this in answer to your question. I believe her ruling that there was no measurable benefit retained is part of an analysis of was there anything unjust about the circumstances. And so by finding that there was no measurable benefit retained, I believe is implicit in that is there was nothing unfair.
Well, no, that doesn't work because that reasoning would say depended upon the refunds, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's a different issue from the question that we were talking about with Mr. Gilchrist, which is whether there's an unjust enrichment claim if there's no refund.
Understood.
Okay.
Yes.
Can I ask you a quick question about schedule and procedure? When was the plaintiff's motion for class certification filed, and was it before or after the refunds?
Your Honor, her first plaintiff's first motion for class certification was filed with the state trial court, I believe.
Okay.
Then the action was removed, and then a renewed or later motion to certify was filed with the federal court.
So at the time that you all made the refunds, there was a pending motion for class certification.
You could say it was pending.
It had been filed.
It had, yes.
Okay.
I don't.
So that takes care of the mootness problem, doesn't it, under Primax?
I believe Enhanced Services' position would concede that, yes.
Okay.
Now, isn't the code provision an attempt to streamline the process for determining who actually authorized a service by requiring a written record?
I think the code provision is attempting to make a clear record of authorization.
So if yes, why shouldn't the failure to comply with the code provision be considered the equivalent of failing to obtain authorization for the service, in which case the retention of payment for the unauthorized service could possibly be considered unjust enrichment.
I think you have to back up, and in order to answer that question, it might be a long-winded answer, but let me try to do the best I can. First, the administrative code section upon which plaintiff relies doesn't apply to the defendants as billing clearinghouses. The administrative second, we don't believe it was violated. And third, even if it applied and even if it was violated, a violation of the code just means not that you don't have real true authorization or that you don't have the plaintiff on tape agreeing to the services and ordering them and agreeing to be paid, agreeing to be charged on her monthly bill for them. What it means is you don't have five pieces of documentation. And not having five pieces of documentation is not the same as lacking real true assent or agreement or authorization.
Can I ask you a question about this?
Sure.
You said, I understand your position to say this regulation doesn't apply to your clients. Let's suppose we disagree about that.
Okay.
Because your clients at least act as if they they want to comply with it. But suppose that regulation does apply. I thought it was pretty clear that that the records were missing some of the requirements, namely the means of requesting the service and the names, addresses, and telephone numbers of all the sales representatives as required by the regulation.
We would respectfully disagree with that. I believe that the record, you do have to piece it together, that the recorded oral conversation whereby plaintiff Lady Dye agreed to the services and agreed to be billed for them on her monthly telephone bill contain at least three out of the five pieces of documentation. The two that you refer to are also within the files of the defendants because before they even allow a service provider like My Local Reach or Advanced Business Systems to submit charges to them, they know who the sales agents are. And
well, they
know.
Hope they know.
They absolutely know. They have that in order to get the services of the defendants, in order to qualify for them, the service providers have to submit who their sales agents are. They have to submit the script of any sales call, and they have to submit and get approval of any script for how they are going to obtain authorization. So we believe that the records of the defendants do comply with the administrative
code.
Those
have all been produced with respect to Lady Dye's?
The record has the record in this case does have present our the documentation that we believe fulfills the requirements of the code.
Would you agree in terms of the regulation that it would provide a defense if you and your clients don't have, if whoever's trying to enforce the charge doesn't have the required documentation?
It might provide a defense to the entity to whom the code applies. And the code applies to a LEC, a PIC, or a billing agent acting for a PEC or a LEC. So it would apply to AT&T, perhaps, as a defense. But we would submit that it would not apply to ESBI or ILD.
Can I ask you one other question?
I
don't want to monopolize this discussion, but you all are discussing Time Warner a good deal, the Indiana Supreme Court's decision on the voluntary payment doctrine. Is it your position that Time Warner removed or overruled the century or so of Indiana cases saying that voluntary payment would not serve as a defense where the plaintiff had been defrauded?
I think Indiana law is unclear on that. We briefed the issue as if Time Warner focuses only on whether payment is made in a recognized uncertainty. In preparing for this oral argument, I tried to review the whole history of the voluntary payment doctrine, and I have to concede that Indiana law is unclear.
Do you think the Indiana Supreme Court would say that somebody who makes a payment in reliance upon fraudulent statements is making a voluntary payment that cannot be recovered?
You know, probably not. I think they would do something. I think they would do something like the Lawson court did. Now, I think plaintiffs read Lawson way too broadly, but I do think that Lawson generally stands for the proposition that the voluntary payment doctrine will not apply where the fee charged was not permitted to be charged. So I do think the Indiana Supreme Court might do something like Lawson does. But what the case of Lawson, the most it would do for plaintiff in this case is perhaps undermine the district court's ruling on voluntary payment. But the key difference is in Lawson, the plaintiff in that case paid the fee without disputing it at all. And in our case, the record is clear that plaintiff paid the fee after disputing it. So there's a clear factual difference. And secondly, Lawson, so the best plaintiffs can get out of Lawson is that it might undermine the application of the voluntary payment doctrine to a case where the fee charge was prohibited. But not as a matter of law. Lawson was a ruling on a motion to dismiss, and it simply said, you might have a cause in action. You might have a cause of action in equity for money had and received. Your complaint shouldn't have been dismissed. But discovery hasn't been done. And under the circumstances of the payment of it was a mortgage documentation fee, after discovery is revealed, it may be that the charge of that fee was justified. You have to look at the total circumstances. And here, I think, by the same token, Lawson doesn't give plaintiff the right to pursue essentially a private right of action based upon a purported code violation for unjust enrichment. You still have to look at the elements of unjust enrichment. Was there unfairness? Was there wrongful conduct? Was there a measurable benefit retained? Is retention of that benefit fair? Is retention of that benefit just? So we would respectfully disagree with plaintiff's contention that there's a body of Indiana case law that permits them to automatically have a claim for unjust enrichment where there is a potential code violation. That's just not the case. Plaintiffs still have to come forward with evidence to prove the essential elements of their two causes of action, and that they have not done. That not only warrants summary judgment in favor of the defendant, but it defeats the claim or it defeats class certification because there are too many individual inquiries necessary for all of the class members as to whether they were treated unjustly, whether they authorized the services, whether they ordered them, whether they received them, whether they paid for them, and whether the defendants retained any measurable benefit.
Well, if we accept the plaintiff's position that there is this implied right of action or incorporation of the administrative code, that wouldn't be so, would it? That is, all the information would be in your client's hands about whether or not you kept these records.
Well, that would be true if violating the code was tantamount to unjust enrichment, or if failure to possess five pieces of documentation was the same as failing to possess real authorization. And I'd like to underscore the fact that the code defines authorization. It doesn't define it in the section that plaintiff relies on for the five-part documentation, but it defines it up in a couple of sections above as an affirmative or express act by the customer clearly agreeing. And that's what we have here. So it's important to note that you might have a real, true authorization. The customer might clearly and affirmatively agree to something, but you might not have five pieces of documentation showing that. Mm-hmm. At the same token, you might have all five pieces of information, customers' names, description of service, means of service, but then when you open up the tape or the recording and listen to it, the customer's confused, or the customer answers no to do you authorize. So they're not one and the same. You can have the five pieces of documentation and have a real valid authorization. You can have an invalid authorization, a confused customer, but still have all five pieces of the documentation. So you can't equate them together. You can't substitute the code requirement for five pieces of information with unjustness, deception, unfairness, or a lack of real, true assent.
Ms. Cox, would the Indiana Attorney General have any ability to do consumer protection enforcement to see that these regulations are complied with?
I believe the IURC would have jurisdiction over a long-distance carrier, a PIC, a local carrier, a LEC, or a billing agent for a PIC or LEC. That doesn't include my clients. So there would be jurisdiction, and I think that means I'm out of time.
No,
is that the warning light? Okay, thank you, sorry. I believe the IURC, and this is illustrated by the case of Micronet versus the IURC, where Micronet contested the applicability of the code and contested jurisdiction by the commission by saying, I'm Micronet, I just provide directory assistance. I'm not a telecommunications provider. The court said, no, you are a telecommunications provider because you got a certificate to operate as a long-distance carrier. Micronet said it was accused of cramming, and it had somebody that actually rendered bills on its behalf. Not a clearinghouse like ESBI and ILD, but somebody that actually sent bills for it to customers. That entity was also considered covered by the code, and it was so the commission has jurisdiction over telecommunications providers, utilities who are regularly engaged in the business of providing telecommunication services. That's who the code applies to, and that's who the Attorney General might have the right to go after for enforcement, but not ESBI and not ILD, because they don't provide telecommunication services and they do not bill customers on behalf of any telecommunications provider. They don't send bills to customers. They're merely a middleman who provides a valuable service to people like My Local Reach and Advanced Business Systems, who would have no other way to get their service charges on local telephone company bills. Thank you.
Thank you very much. How much time does Mr. He has a minute? Well, Ms. Cox took at least another minute, so would you give Mr. Gilchrist 3 minutes, please?
Thank you, Your Honor. I would point out to the court that in all of their briefing and in their arguments today, although they've certainly done a very good job, the defendants have never mentioned subsection Q of the regulation. And subsection Q is the section that specifically states that these entities may not collect compensation for imposing LEC bills without satisfying the regulation. And it is that prohibition that really...
Well, they're maintaining they satisfied the regulation, so why would they be getting into Q or anything resembling it?
Well, if they want to address some of the other arguments that are present in the case, I think they might want to do that, because it's the violation of subsection Q, which is an absolute prohibition of the fee, that really positions this case when it comes to matters such as the voluntary payment doctrine, and equity, and how equity is going to treat a claim in a case like this. In terms of the question that was put to defendant's counsel regarding compliance, I would point out to the court that the recording that's been mentioned here, and it was mentioned by Ms. Cox, there is no evidence in the record that it was ever in the possession of either the defendants or the LEC. And so we don't agree that the recording satisfied the regulation, but the regulation requires that it be in their possession before they impose a charge. And the record doesn't show.
Don't you have a pretty good claim against AT&T here?
There may be a claim against AT&T. We didn't
pursue
AT&T.
We know they're subject to the regulation, right?
AT&T would be subject to the regulation as well.
And do they get all these copies of this documentation every time they add a bill, add a charge to a bill?
AT&T receives whatever these billing aggregators forward to them. They don't receive anything else. And we think that they did also, their possession requirement also was not satisfied. However, we think the billing...
Can you recover from everybody?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Can you recover from AT&T as well as from the defendants?
I think that AT&T violated the code. I think that the actual causes of action that we have brought are more appropriately brought against the billing aggregators. They are the gatekeepers. They are the ones who control ultimately somebody's access to the phone bill.
There's and no they are doubt, also. Though, I mean, we've got a debate here about whether they're even covered by the regulation. That's the
foundation
of your claim.
We do.
There's no doubt about AT&T.
Well, that's correct. They are LEC and they're covered by the regulation.
So why didn't you sue them?
Why did we not sue them? Frankly, Your Honor, they're subject to an arbitration clause and they're subject to a no class action clause. And in order to pursue a case like this, to make it worthwhile to pursue and find a remedy for even the plaintiff, let alone the class, you have to aggregate claims. And that's a truth that this circuit has recognized.
Under the Concepcion case more recently now? The same.
Is that the U.S. Supreme Court case? That's
one.
Right. It offers a good example of the problem that faces consumers trying to enforce remedies like this.
All right. Thank you to one and all. Case will be taken under advisement.